This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua An Teck. My guest today, Lee Kwok Ngan, is a senior fellow at the ICS Yusof Ishak Institute in Singapore. ICS is short for the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies. He recently released a study titled Malaysia's Bumiputra Preferential Regime and Transformation Agenda, Modified Programs, Unchanged System. I am led to believe it's deliberately a mouthful by Dr. Lee himself. Welcome. How have you been? Because I think since we last spoke, you've moved countries, you've moved jobs. You used to teach at University of Malaya. You used to head the developmental studies program there. Tell me about your new role. What do you do, and who is your work aimed at nowadays?
Yeah, hi, Intik. Thank you very much for this invitation back. It's a pleasure to be back and to talk about this mouthful of a topic. I'm doing well. It's nice to be in a fully research position and to look afresh at Malaysia, I think, in some ways. And this is ongoing work. It's a bit of updating that I did, and I've just tried to frame the issue in a way that I hope is a bit clearer, or at least more focused and more systematic with this Bumiputra preferential regime.
Yeah. I always like talking to you about this because the topic itself is always provokes a lot of emotion, is very heated, and just saying the word itself incites a lot of stereotypes, caricatures, ideas of unfairness. But you chose the word preferential regime very deliberately. And maybe I should also bring in an article that you wrote recently for the New Mandala, in which you wrote that this pro-Malay ethnic preferential regime we have is, quote, extensive, embedded, and often misconstrued, end quote. What do you mean by that? What are the misconceptions?
Yeah, okay. Well, I suppose I should own up for this mouthful of a title again. Bumiputra preferential regime. I think some other terms that are used, that are trying to get at the same, trying to describe, the same thing, a system. Probably the most common is affirmative action, and I think the way that what I'm referring to here is, would be aligned with affirmative action as that term is, used in international literature for us to make comparative studies. But in Malaysia, you have 100 people in the room and you have 100 definitions of affirmative action. And I find that it's a bit of a trigger to when just using that word, people will then just rush to their own preconceived notions. And you don't, first they have that common ground because for some it means, it just means different things. For some it's just everything, anti-poverty programs, and the ethnic-based programs as well. So I thought it would be important and timely that we be clear about what I'm talking about, that it is about ethnicity, favoring the Bumiputras, that they're preferential treatment that is involved. And I think that's because we do tend to overlook how extensive it is, the whole range, the scope of interventions that there are. And it's a regime because it encompasses, various spheres. So then to the question about, how I describe it as being embedded, extensive, and often misconstrued. It's embedded in that constitution provides for these interventions that are, again, Bumiputra preference. And very extensive, especially since the new economic policy where preferential programs were massively expanded. But it's also misconstrued, I think, because we now have a lot of, rhetoric that is bandied about race-based, need-based, merit-based, And I think we are in quite a muddle about how these relate to each other. I'm sure we'll be talking about how they do, but I think maybe I can just state, you know, right now, I think the position that I hold, which is that we need to firstly grasp the full range, the objectives, firstly, of this regime, its full range of interventions as they are right now, which are ethnicity-based, and we need to find ways to incorporate need-based criteria and merit-based to reinforce Bumiputra empowerment in order that we could actually find, you know, some ways to roll it back, which I hold is ultimately the objective. And I think many do. And I think the popular reception of you know, wanting to have less race-based policies, you know, I think is springs from a desire to, you know, to move on. But before we move on, we have to have a more coherent and systematic thinking and planning moving forward. When I say extensive, right, its particular applications are in higher education, where there are scholarships, where admissions criteria comes into play, and in employment, in the public sector, in GLCs, where it's not necessarily a formal written policy, but you could see that in practice, and in enterprise development through contracting, through awarding of licenses and so on, as well as in wealth ownership, right, like equity. Yeah, and property.
Okay.
Yeah.
What you said about us having to be clear about the objective is, one is for Bumiputra empowerment and cultivating of capabilities and eventually to roll back the need for any sort of affirmative action program. So this objective would encompass all policy spheres. They run across all three policies?
I think when... Yes. I think it's helpful to focus on the empowerment, and okay, that's maybe still also a bit vague. I think empowerment meaning enhancing capability and competitiveness, you know, in terms of, so again, I repeat, right, it's really focused on these particular spheres of higher education, where it's about knowledge and skills transfer and acquisition, in employment, you know, where on the job, right, there should be learning happening, and in enterprise development. So the objective, you know, remains even if there have been, you know, various shortcomings in the way that's it's been implemented. I do want to add on, though, I think by saying it, we should roll back. I am referring to specifically what I call the more overtly ethnic preference. That's what we want to phase out. And of course, well, if one thing is phased out, what's phased in? I think Malaysia will always need to be attuned to ethnic equitable representation, especially in areas, you know, positions that have involved decision-making, that confer economic influence and power. But we don't always have to be based on, you know, quota or very overt ethnic preference. I mean, I think we need to explore the range of alternatives out there. But I'm not saying that just eliminate and have nothing to replace it, or that ethnicity doesn't matter, you know, right, or the diversity doesn't matter. I think diversity will continually matter for the national integrity and social fabric.
What is an example of an overt ethnic-based preferential treatment in higher education, for example?
Well, we've had it in the past with more direct quotas. Let's unpack that a little bit, because I think it's actually symptomatic of, you know, a lot of muddled thinking that goes on. So, you know, the dogma is that there is meritocracy in, let's focus now specifically, university, public university admissions. And at one level, yes, technically you could say, because, you know, the admissions only looks at points, only looks at grades. But there are parallel entry points. The secondary education, late secondary, or actually it's post-secondary, like matriculation, STPM. So when meritocracy was sort of announced to great fanfare, it was saying that, look, if you get an A in STPM, you get an A in matriculation, they count as the same. We only look at those grades and not look at identity. Fair enough, but those systems, you know, are not on par in terms of the level of difficulty. Matriculation is known to be easier, and so it's not quite a meritocratic in technically as well. And on top of that, there is a quota in matriculation colleges, a 90% Bumiputra quota. Now, I'm saying this, you know, not to stir any controversy, but it's just something that is factual that I think we just need to have an honest and critical discussion about. Because I think matriculation by university admissions, right, by having this veneer of meritocracy, it's firstly incorrect, and it's also sending the wrong signal, because you actually apply a 90% quota at the matriculation programs. And there are also some that are exclusively Bumiputra in the ASASI. My point here is that it shows that representation matters. It matters for the nation. It matters for people that they to have a fair opportunity, and that some have come with disadvantages in, you know, from family background. And education is really is the most powerful instrument of empowerment, of upward mobility, because it is targeting beneficiaries, you know, at an early adulthood, so they're still quite young. It is principally about acquiring knowledge and skills and launching into, you know, working life and career. And it's also very powerful in that it can target beneficiaries based on need. So, yeah, we want to strive for the ethnic representation. But in education, I think we can have a mix of preference based on disadvantaged background, striving for that kind of ethnic diversity. Yeah.
I'm speaking today to Lee Hwok Un, Senior Fellow at ICS Yusof Ishak Institute. We're talking about his paper on Malaysia's Bumiputra Preferential Regime and Transformation Agenda. Up next, I'll ask him about what he has to say about how we are approaching representation in high-level employment and enterprise development. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Antek. My guest today, Lee Hwok Un, is a senior fellow at ICS Yusof Ishak Institute in Singapore. His recent paper, Malaysia's Bumiputra Preferential Regime and Transformation Agenda, Modified Programs and Unchanged System, looks at how Malaysia is approaching its affirmative action programs and trying to achieve more equitable wealth distribution, addressing income inequality, access to higher education. That was what we covered in the first half. And the sense I got from what you've said, Hwok Un, was that we need eventually to transition away from the current program we have. And the concession, it seems, is reflected in some of the more targeted programs that they have introduced, the Bumiputra Economic Transformation Program, or recently the TN50, the National Transformation Program, mm-hmm. which are more targeted within the Bumiputra community on trying to uplift their skills and capability and competitive level. Within this scheme of trying to introduce merit-based consideration, is it merit within an ethnicity?
Yeah, precisely. So I think the confusion arises when, you know, when this sort of merit-based affirmative action, that notion, is presented as something, you know, that is quite monolithic, and then it's construed as a replacement for race-based. Right from the beginning, when the ideas, you know, this rhetoric was first floated in the new economic model, it was never clear. It became apparent that actually what they meant was selecting more capable Bhumiputra over less capable Bhumiputra, just to put it simply. It was not to replace a Bhumiputra preferential system with a merit-based system that did not at all take into account ethnicity. So you've pointed it out, and I think, yeah, that's the way that it actually makes sense, because the objective in some of us, so we're now talking specifically more about more specifically the enterprise development. The objective is to distribute opportunities in an area where, you know, the group's participation was lacking, that they could be a certain champion, a certain example for the community that others might follow, that would lift the esteem of the community as a whole. I mean, if you go back to 1950s, 60s, even the introduction of the new economic policy, you know, the absence of Malays in business, in owning and operating enterprises, I think, was very, very stark. Equity ownership was, you know, 2%. And so that was still as a basis to say that, look, I mean, it's for the community and for international interest to have programs that will promote their advancement into this sector. In which case, if you want it to succeed, well, you should target, right, the beneficiaries who can excel, not on the basis of they're poor, that they should be receiving more treatment. But if you can really have the, if you have the potential, if you have the, if you have the ability and the drive, that you're given the opportunity. But it should also come with certain other qualifications. This is the next challenge in graduating, and here I think we can you know, apply again some of that the idea of need-based considerations. So if we take the example of government contracting. So again, this is again a lot, you know, how need-based considerations, merit-based, can reinforce the Bhumiputra preferential regime towards making it, you know, more effective, and that we could, you know, roll back more this overt ethnic preference. And some of the things that we haven't really considered, and here's where we can bring in a need-based consideration, but distinctly different from education. In education, I think the basis for giving preference to those who have from disadvantaged backgrounds is clear. And the moral, you know, ground is also quite morally grounded, because you're dealing with teenagers or late teens, so they're still dependent, and they have coming from disadvantages in their family and in their schooling. Very importantly here to stress, circumstances not of their own choosing, largely out of their control, where you grew up, the school that you attended. So the basic, so on that grounds, to say that, okay, you didn't really qualify on grades alone, but because we acknowledge disadvantaged backgrounds, we can give you some preferential entry. Now, in the sphere of enterprise development, we're dealing with adults, and the consequences are not just to attend classes, but here to actually deliver on something, to construct something. I think we get into a lot of trouble. The moral basis is grossly diminished to say that, oh, we should give preference based on background, because you're adults, people, you know, cannot lean on, oh, I have a disadvantaged background, to claim some kind of preferential treatment. But the idea here should be that it's about merit. Where we can bring in need is more the inverse, that if someone has been receiving preferential access to contracts, let's say, for a certain amount of time or a certain number of repetitions contracts, then you do not need it so much anymore. So you can be disqualified from getting preferential treatment. Right, so inverted in that, you can receive it, but after a while, you don't need it so much anymore. So you should let others, you know, have that opportunity. Or we can also introduce, let's say, a limit on because there are different scales of contractors, and one of the realities that is that Bhumiputra contractors, the vast majority are at the smallest scale. It's now called G1, and you know, it is something that just keeps repeated. Oh, this is the situation. But we've not introduced, I think, some of the potential ways that we could try to, you know, nudge away from the situation, including what I just said. You can receive a contract at G1 for a certain number of times. After that, you cannot get preferential treatment anymore. You can move up. You have to move up in order to get, you know, preferential treatment. Or you have a point system. If you did scale up, you get extra points. I mean, these are things, you know, this can be further fine-tuned. But it's reinforcing it, right, by saying need, but for, on the other basis. And I think similarly for, you know, for things like wealth accumulation, like and I think actually it's been put on the table, the property discount in
1 million
of 1 million, on that basis, that look, you don't need that assistance, that preferential treatment, so we can afford to, right, we can cut it.
So within this framework of pursuing merit, at what point do you say empowerment has been achieved? Do you always try to reflect the national racial composition?
Yeah, that's a really hard one. That I, you know, I think it needs to. We need a national conversation about that. What I would say is, we have this regime which has, you know, various spheres of intervention: higher education, employment, and enterprise development, and wealth. I don't think, firstly, that we can have a standard benchmark or threshold that, oh, we achieve 67% Bumiputra, 24% Chinese, 7% Indian, and then we're done. Or we do this for 10 years, 20 years, and then dissolves. Because we should try that. And in some cases, it exceeded the proportionality, like in public sector employment. And you know, it didn't, you know, trigger reforms. And the NEP had this 20-year target, which I think actually, you know, was not so feasible to begin with, and I don't really look back on it with such regret that, oh, it continued after 20 years. But I bring this up here just to show that, you know, you just set a time limit and then say it's over. It's not going to work. What we really need to do is look at these areas of intervention and I think have a conversation, a critical discussion. I cannot provide the answer, but we have to have, you know, many inputs on which are appropriate, which approach is more appropriate for which sphere. In some cases, a time limit might be more useful. And again, not a time limit that will just be all do it all now, and then when it expires, get rid of the entire thing, but a scheduled time-based rolling back. In some others, it could be more an issue based on milestones. So you achieve this, and then you can, you know, then you remove it. So I think what I would like to offer here is more the framework and the perspective. I think we also need to be mindful that in some, the level of some of the barriers, right, to becoming capable and competitive and have a secure footing differ. In education, you know, it's 4 years, it's about, you know, doing well in your studies and all that. Compare that, you know, with moving up into the higher echelons of employment, and then one of the hardest would be, you know, the Bumiputra enterprise being competitive and self-reliant there. So each they have different timelines as well. I think if we can reasonably make the case that in education they can be rolled back and you know, the reforms can happen in the nearer future, but in the other spheres, because, you know, it would take certain pioneering generations, or because, you know, it's really difficult and there's going to be failures and stumblings along the way in being competitive and not just nationally but internationally. So there could be the case it can be made for a longer term horizon for the other interventions, like in enterprise promoting competitive and capable and enterprises. Yeah. But you know, I think we also need to somehow really shift away from being very ethnocentric and reactive about wealth and ownership. And one way to do that might be to just shine the spotlight on fairness. So if whether businesses are operating in a way that is fair, and so wealth acquisition, is it by the by the rules, right? Versus who's owning what, and also I think the issue of privilege should occupy a bigger part of the conversation, because a lot of wealth is also passed on from generation to generation. It's within families. And so I think maybe the case for interventions that are based on these sort of privilege, like, inheritance, taxes, and that sort of thing, those are kind of also, I think, maybe parallel policies and discourses that can help move us away from the fixation with ethnicity, because I don't think we can resolve the issues and reform by just saying that, if the pie is carved up by according to ethnicity in this way, then we will have arrived.
You spoke to many people who have benefited off this preferential regime for this study, mm-hmm. people who are in decision-making positions in these government agencies that are tasked with enforcing mm-hmm. and executing transformation programs or ethnic targeted programs. What is your sense of what they feel or their attitudes towards this regime? Do they see it as a crutch that is needed to uplift what is considered a historical injustice or imbalance? Or do they see it as a temporary need mm-hmm. or a band-aid that mm-hmm. can be rolled back soon?
I think some are just so embedded, it's just taken for granted that it is what it is, and there's no very little, if any, conversations about is there going to be reforms? Are we going to roll it back? And when it in education, admission system, the matriculation in MARA programs, for instance, but there is this Bumiputra Economic Transformation Program. And there's an agency that's overseeing that, Teraju. Credit should be given where credit is due in some of the new approaches that are being applied there. And I think there, some that I think deserve to be mentioned, and I do in the article. It's partly to dispel, I think, some of the misconceptions. And I think usually probably from, just kind of reactive, right? Those that just react when they see, Bumiputra Economic Transformation Program. Okay, here we go again, same old, same old. Mm-hmm. But I think with the, firstly, for the Raju programs, its criteria, anyway, of that excludes JLC subsidiaries is an important element, because that's what we've been, that's been a complaint all along, that the JLC dominance and so on, and who others is, who else is benefiting. So it's striving to go beyond, I think it's really also striving to not do the same, you know, certainly striving to avoid the patronage and politicized deviations in the past and be a bit more professionalized to strive for, you know, and competitive in the selection. I can see that it is meaningful and different. Within that, also in education, there is one Yayasan Peneraju, and it has a specific focus on disadvantaged backgrounds. So Bumiputras, but not in general. And they really, I think, dig deeper into the history and want to reach out to those from a disadvantaged background, and particularly, you know, providing support, scholarships, and a bit of mentorship as well. I think that's a key in technical education. So, well, just on the plus side, but I think there's a bit of a silo mentality, and in which we're doing our thing, and we have a little, this is our mandate. So it's not so much, you know, that the agencies, I think, but more who is the government with giving a broader vision to what's going on that I don't see, which is, okay, we have these interventions and they're focused on what they're doing, but what do we do with the lessons that we learn? How does, let's say, Yayasan Peneraju, what we can learn from that, you know, translate into the broader system? Where, and the magnitude, you know, is far, far greater, right, for the university admissions and MARA programs and so on, which I think tend to be, you know, operating very much in rather an autopilot or just, you know, not really being very concerned about how they might change and be more effective. And similarly with the Raju and you know, what it's doing and this emphasis on capability competitiveness, why don't we look at how this can inform, you know, government, the whole government contracting system? I think there's a lot of turf guarding and territorialism, and which is normal, but really we need to, you know, mm-hmm. breach that and have more, you know, rigorous policy and a bit more courage in confronting the vested interests here. One more thing I do want to say, and this one is, I think, a bit troubling. I do not like the expansion in the later Bumiputra economic transformation, so the BETR 2, where it ventures into well-being. I think it's very problematic to, because it's exceeded its original scope, which I thought was reasonable and sensible for, you know, for Taraju, for Bumiputra economic transformation, to be focused on those spheres, higher education, employment, enterprise development. Because these are about, right, selecting members from a group into certain positions that then can yield greater benefits and self-reliant that the community can, you know, would be empowered, you know, through the elevation, right, of these members of the community. It's a distribution of opportunities and also privileges. But well-being, and it talks about health and housing and those sort of things, I think that really should not have a part. You know, ethnicity should not factor in there. And I find it actually troubling when it's now talking about health. I mean, why, you know, that is basic needs. That's just about human rights. All citizens, you know, have a basic right to health provisions, public health provision, basic schooling, primary, secondary, those sort of things. And that's a totally separate mandate. So I think I would wish that they can, you know, retract from that and go back to the original scope and that focus and do it well. And I don't see how venturing into well-being is also translating into clear policies. And if it actually does, then it's really, that's really disturbing if there would be ethnic preferential programs that are targeting health.
Right.
Yeah.
I think I'll end with this. Your new Mandala article asking why would any rational person voluntarily or willingly give up privilege, our existing privilege. Mm-hmm. It got me thinking about this question on whether short-term fairness should be sometimes sacrificed to achieve long-term social justice. The most common example most people would think of is JPA scholarships that are awarded to a student whose result was inferior to someone, but the person with the higher result was overlooked because he or she came from a wealthier background. Mm-hmm. What would your message be to that?
Yeah, this is something that is the dilemma, I think. I guess it goes to the core of it. Firstly, I think I take things as they are and not pose counterfactuals. I think there is a tendency among, many that I've talked to say that, if only we had not done this in the first place, we would not have this problem. That is an interesting thought to hold, and you could, run your simulations about what would have happened without the NEP, but the fact is that this is the state that we're in. And if we are going, again, I do want to, rehash a bit. If we do want to, right, I think to truly achieve that rolling back of the overt preferential system, then on a mass scale, there has to be some level of critical mass that feel that there is a sufficient empowerment that they can truly countenance, some removal of that preferential scheme. It will take, I think, political courage. It will take, social movements, and I think a growing consensus, and I think tangible demonstration as well. I think overall, we can approach it in two ways. I can simplify it. I think some will say that, look, it's failed, let's get rid of it. I understand the frustrations that underlie that, and I think, that's that should be space for articulating that. But that has been articulated for, I don't know, maybe 40 years. And it's not been mostly by the minorities, those who are, feel disenfranchised, denied the opportunities. And no, it's not helped Malaysia pass, a certain threshold that we can have a national consensus to say that we should, move on and roll it back. I think we should, which suggests to me that the way forward, the only way that we could actually move along and truly reform is when we say that, look, it has succeeded, so we do not need it anymore. I think that's the only way that we can really, and the majority group would have to really, be at the forefront of that. The Malays, the Bumiputras, to say that, yes, we have all achieved all this, therefore I do not need it anymore. I do not need the special assistance. Again, not to say that we totally abandon and then, have eliminate everything. Sometimes even, middle class, the rich may feel, why should I be so, denied all these opportunities? Fair enough. Introduce scholarships that are competitive and you don't factor in background. They don't necessarily have to be fully funded. I think we have not thought about that enough. So you can establish prestigious scholarships that are very rigorous and to award the excellence, promote that kind of healthy competition. But if you can afford to chip in more, then the scholarship amount, can be adjusted accordingly. I don't see how that should be so difficult. Challenging, yes, but I don't think that, I think there's potential there to address, the different contending interests. And so we don't just say that, now it's all only benefiting low income and nothing else for the M40, or even the top 20. We can have different programs that are also, meeting the different income, the circumstances and grievances of the different income levels.
Hotman, thank you very much for speaking to me today.
Thank you very much, Intik.
You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.